Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Thank you. Thank you for all coming out on a sleepy Sunday afternoon. I appreciate it. Can you all hear me in the cheap seats? Okay. I want to begin by asking just one question. Is there anybody here today who's a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan? I guess not. Santa Barbara is not a big military town, huh? Okay. I also want to mention that my wife is here in the audience, so you have to be nice. And my sister, Margaret Ricks, and her husband, Mike Doherty, and Mike's a big wig here at the campus, so it's another reason to be nice. He's the chairman of mechanical engineering or all engineering? Chemical. I get them mixed up. I'm not very scientific. There are several things the American people don't understand about the Iraq war right now. And three of the most important are, number one, how difficult the surge was, the spring of 2007. Second, that the surge failed. It achieved its military goal, it improved security, but it failed in achieving its stated goal of leading to a political breakthrough in Iraq. The third thing that I think the American people don't understand is this war is not over. It is far from over. Sure, it's changed. It was an invasion, an occupation, an insurgency, a civil war, a counteroffensive. It'll keep changing, but it hasn't gone away, even though the American people would like it to go away. In fact, I think we may only be halfway through this thing. And if that's true, Obama's war in Iraq will wind up being longer than President Bush's war of 5 years and 10 months. And I'm going to try to use this rest of my time to talk here to explain that. First, how tough the surge was. This is one of the major themes of the book. I think people back here forgot or never understood just how hard it was, what happened in Iraq in the first half of 2007, and then to a lesser degree for the following 12 months. In my book, General Petraeus, when I asked him about it the last time I interviewed him in October, said when he looks back on that period, the spring of 2007, he thinks of it as a, quote, horrific nightmare. This is not a man given to overstatement. In the spring of 2007, American troops had to fight their way into the city of Baghdad. They had been located on big forward operating bases, not really in the city. And they went out on patrols, and then they went back to those bases. When you do a one-hour patrol a day in a neighborhood, the enemy, the insurgents, or simply bandits can control it for the other 23 hours of the day. American troops had to fight their way to little outposts where they were going to go out and try to protect the population. There were 70 U.S. troops killed in action in February 2007, 71 KIA in March. 96 KIA in April, 120 KIA in May. And during this period, there was no sign of an improvement of security, no sign of a turnaround. The one section of the book I want to read today is about this period. It's called The Hardest Step. And it's about them trying to move into the city from the big bases. By coincidence, I just noticed this book will go on the New York Times bestseller list a week from today. And I just noticed that the Times has posted this section on its website starting next week. Moving American soldiers from big isolated bases and into new posts of 35 men to around 100 men located in vacant schoolhouses, factories, and apartment buildings in Baghdad's neighborhoods was the hardest step of the war. Essentially, U.S. forces were sallying out to launch a counteroffensive to retake the city. The first days were surprisingly violent, with an average of almost 180 attacks a day on U.S. forces. That was the Battle of Baghdad, Petraeus said, looking back 18 months later. It was just very, very difficult, very, very hard. During February 2007, Baghdad suffered an average of more than one car bomb attack a day. Between late January and late February, at least 8 U.S. helicopters were shot down. In March 2007, the 2nd Surge Unit, the 4th Brigade of the 1st Infantry Division, began operations in western Baghdad. One skeptical soldier from the Big Red One told a reporter that he didn't expect the new approach to work. "It's getting worse and worse," he said. "They don't respect us anymore. They spit at us. They throw rocks at us. It wasn't like that before." In some Shiite neighborhoods, units were greeted by stacked loudspeakers, blaring the chants of the Jaish al-Mahdi, Muqtadir al-Sadr's Shiite militia. In Sunni neighborhoods that had been ethnically cleansed, patrolling soldiers often found piles of executed bodies and vacant houses with blood smeared on the walls. This is how the operations officer for a battalion operating in southwest Baghdad recalled that time to a researcher from the official Center for Army Lessons Learned. "When we first moved into the AO, that's Area of Operations, it was house-to-house clearing and fighting most of the way. It took months before we could drive more than halfway north through the Mahalla, which means the neighborhood, without hitting multiple IEDs and taking fire." The first task of the troops as they moved into the city was simply surviving. "Our first 2 weeks were tough," Lieutenant Jacob Carlisle, a platoon leader, later said. "We had to clear every day, and we got hit every day." Indeed, in June, he would be shot in the thigh and hit by shrapnel in the face and arm. When Baker Company, a unit in the 2nd Infantry Division, moved into the Dura neighborhood in southern Baghdad, it was greeted with constant enemy small arms fire, IEDs, rocket-propelled grenades, and grenade attacks, often surprisingly coordinated, recalled Lieutenant Tim Gross, a platoon leader. Baker Company began by spending 3 nights using shovels, screwdrivers, and tire irons to remove 18 deep-buried bombs in its area. A deep-buried bomb is a bomb that's obviously down deep, but sufficiently large enough to blow an armored vehicle into the air. Baker Company began with almost no information from the people of the area, who had felt abused by Iraq police operating there. Indeed, Baker later would ban the most abusive of the police, the militia-infested National Police, from entering the neighborhood. I read that just because I think people here never really got how hard this was to go out and do these things. There was one outpost at Tarmia, which had a day, one day, that was reminiscent of the movie Zulu. I don't know if you ever see this old Michael Caine movie. It was an outpost. It was the northernmost outpost of the 1st Cavalry Division north of Baghdad, about 15 miles north in this little village of Tarmia, right on the Tigris River. One day at 7 a.m., they were hit by a concentrated attack of rocket-propelled grenades, followed by a truck bomb that could be heard 7 miles away when it exploded. There were 38 soldiers in this little outpost. At the end of the day, 2 were dead and 29 were wounded. The interesting thing was they held the outpost. And by that night, their commander had established a new outpost. The building they were in was too rubbleized to stay in, but they picked a new vacant building and moved into that. The second misunderstood aspect of the surge was who was running it. In the winter and spring of 2007, President Bush effectively turned this war over to the dissidents inside the military, at the State Department, and elsewhere in the U.S. government. These were people who had opposed the war or had been sharp critics of how the occupation had been conducted. For example, Ambassador Ryan Crocker, who was the top U.S. diplomat in Iraq for the last couple of years, reveals in my book that he was essentially opposed to the invasion of Iraq. General Petraeus, before going out to Iraq, had overseen the writing of a manual on counterinsurgency that affected to a scathing critique of how the war had been conducted until that point. One aspect of this that really brings home how different this operation was the 3 foreigners who became major advisors to the execution of the surge in the spring of 07. The first was David Kilcullen, an Australian infantry officer who became an anthropologist and became an expert on the ethnography of violence in Iraq, how Sunni violence differed from Shiite violence in this period. Sunni violence, for example, tended to be brought into Shiite public places, mosque and marketplace especially, and done during the daytime. Shiite violence against Sunnis tended to be brought into Sunni homes, neighborhoods where people slept, and so it occurred at night, usually through death squads. And so the ways they found to, under his coaching, to interfere with this violence and to bring it down were very different. You would put up checkpoints outside of marketplaces and mosques. And if the car bomb went off at the checkpoint and only killed 2 Iraqi soldiers, that was deemed a victory. You lose two Iraqi soldiers instead of 35 or 70 or 100 Shiite civilians. For the Sunni neighborhoods, they decided, in order to protect them, and the city was largely ethnically cleansed by the time the surge began, there were a few little Sunni enclaves left in western Baghdad that, you know, when I say they weren't tiny, there were several hundred thousand people, but this is a city of 6 million people. They put up walls around them. This was controversial at the time because it resembled what Israel was doing with Palestinian neighborhoods. But the purpose was to prevent Shiite death squads from entering them. If you only had one entrance to a neighborhood and there were soldiers watching it all the time, even if a Shiite death squad snuck in, it would be very difficult for them to get back out. The second person who became an advisor was Saadi Othman, a Brazilian-born Palestinian-American who on 9/11 was a taxi driver in New York City and decided to do something to become involved in this. He felt violated as a New Yorker, as an American, and as a Palestinian-American. He wound up as a translator for American forces in northern Iraq, and there he met one day this little shrimp of a guy coming out of the men's room, just wearing a T-shirt, and they ended up having an hour-long conversation. It turned out to be General David Petraeus, who said, "You're coming to work for me." Saadi, interestingly, is a couple of aspects of his education. He's 6'7" and became the first man ever to dunk a basketball in Jordanian university competition. He was also educated by Mennonites and ended up going to a Mennonite college in the United States and was a pacifist. Interestingly, the third major foreign advisor was also a pacifist, and perhaps the most extraordinary of the three, Emma Skye, a bird-like British woman, tiny, anti-American, anti-military, anti-war, became an advisor to General Raymond Odierno, this hulking, classic, conventional general who in many ways was the villain of my first book on the Iraq War, Fiasco. I think General Odierno understood he needed to operate differently. And so he had met Emma Skye in Iraq and called her up. And he knew Emma knew Iraq. She speaks Arabic. She speaks Hebrew. She was really familiar with northern Iraq. In fact, there was the joke in 2004 was that she had become the mayor of the town of Erbil in Kurdish Iraq. He called Emma Skye up one day and said, "Look, I'm going back to Iraq. I'd like you to be my political advisor." By coincidence, Emma had read the book Fiasco the previous weekend. And she said, one of the more interesting comments I think ever in a job interview, she said, "I'll take the job on one condition. The first time, General Odierno, that I see you commit or condone a war crime, I'm personally reporting you to the War Crime Tribunal in The Hague." He said, "Okay, you're hired." What she didn't know was the United States military and government don't subscribe to the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. But I think the point was a larger point. Emma was saying, "If I see you guys do things that I consider illegal, I will make it public." And he was willing to take the bet, which was to his credit. Petraeus one day referred to her as Odierno's insurgent. Her advice was not always welcome, but she sure made sure it was heard. I think the two points I take away from these foreign advisors that were brought in were, number one, the Americans were showing a little humility finally in Iraq, a willingness to listen to Iraqis, to other foreigners, a sense that there might be more than one way than the American way, a sense that we didn't have it all figured out, and it might be time to shut up and listen. So while I emphasized at the beginning the toughness of this 6 months, the other aspect was it was a lot about talking rather than fighting. Talking to Iraqis, even talking to the enemy. Petraeus at one point basically put the Iraqi Sunni insurgency on the American payroll to the tune of $30 million a month. And that really diffused the violence in western Iraq. In my October interview with Petraeus, the last of a series I did over a couple of years with him and other people, I said, "I'm curious. I can't figure out one aspect of this, General. How did you sell President Bush on the notion of putting the enemy on the American payroll?" And Odierno said, "Well, I didn't ask." And I said, "You're kidding me. This is one of the biggest policy changes in the war, you know, taking the evildoers and giving the money." And he said, "No, it was within my existing authorities." Well, you want audacity in your generals, and that's audacious, because if that had gone wrong, if that had blown up in his face, I think he would have been tagged with it. He would have been blamed with it. As it happened, it worked very well. Once the Sunni insurgency was on the American payroll, the Shiite militias didn't want to be the only person in the gunsights of the Americans, and so they sort of said, okay, we're going to stand down too. And suddenly, Iraq got a lot more quiet. The one group that really hated this deal, by the way, was the Baghdad government. We cut these deals with the Sunnis insurgents without telling the Baghdad government. And as one Shiite politician quoted in the book says, baby crocodiles are cute, but you can't keep adult crocodiles in the house. And the opinion of many Shiite politicians is the Americans have been feeding these baby crocodiles, these militias, and then we're going to bug out and leave them with adult crocodiles snapping at their heels inside their house, which is one reason I think violence may increase down the road. Talking instead of fighting. My favorite example of this in the book, and it's really my, I think, my favorite section of the book, is the section called The Insurgent Who Loved Titanic. There was a captain in the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment named Sam Cook, interestingly. And Sam's father was a professor of religion in Northern Ireland, but Sam wound up a captain of the American Army. In his little town, he heard about a local insurgent who boasted of having planted 200 bombs against the Americans since he became radicalized by the Abu Ghraib scandal back in the spring of 04. Now, normally, in this war usually, when an American officer heard about an insurgent who credibly boasted of having planted 200 bombs, what the American officer would do is plan a raid and go down and capture this guy or kill him in the course of trying to capture him. And if he were captured alive, ship him off to a detention facility where somebody would interrogate him eventually. But that hadn't worked real well. And so Sam did something different. He invited the guy over a cup of tea. This was a very different American military. The insurgent shows up, kind of curious. Here I am, he says. Why haven't you arrested me if you knew where I was? And Sam said, well, if I saw you on the street, I might shoot you, I might arrest you. But here you are, my guest, and under the rules of hospitality, I will not arrest you. We are free to sit and have tea, and you can leave whenever you like. And so they began to talk. And they agreed to meet several times. The insurgent was kind of worried by how Al-Qaeda was behaving in his neighborhood. And he was concerned about where Iraq was going. And so he would come back and talk. Now, at the same time, these guys were very aware of each other. At one point, Captain Cook found out that the insurgent had a photograph of this guy he was circulating in case he had to have him killed. Cook, meanwhile, had his bodyguard, his snipers, come in and take a good look at this guy one day so they'd be able to take him out if they ever needed to. But they talked. One day, the insurgent said to Sam, I hate America. America is the devil. Nothing good can come of America. Well, Sam had knocked around Iraq for a while, and even the most popular cell phone ringtone in Iraq is the theme from Titanic, the movie. Sam knew that every Iraqi seems to have seen Titanic, and so Sam says, well, you saw Titanic, didn't you? And the insurgent said, oh, yes, 7 times. And I cry every time at the end when Leonardo DiCaprio slips into the sea. And this was the common ground they found as they continued to talk. A few weeks later, the insurgent said, okay, I'm going to come in a reconciliation ceremony, and I will bring in my network. And I'll tell you how things happen. And this sort of conversation would happen again and again in Iraq over the last couple of years. The conversations would be, and these are real quotes from these debriefing interviews that they did. You know that sniper rifle you found me with? That was a gift from the Iraqi major you work with. You know why you guys never caught me? This insurgent told Sam Cook. Because when your guys got to the police checkpoint near my house, the police would call me. By the way, you should take away the cell phones from the police at checkpoints. You know why you never caught me when you tossed my house? Because we dug a pit out back and put a trap door over it, and our family cow was trained to sit on the trap door. And you Americans were too nice to the animals. Sam said later that it was like having a light turned on. You could see everything all of a sudden. You could see how things operated. In Fallujah, the former insurgent said, you might want to go down to the mechanic shop and every morning write down all the numbers of all the cars that are in there. And then have the mechanics account for the dispositions of the cars. Why? It's because that's where the car bombs were built. And by the way, go over to the hospital and number all the oxygen tanks. because that's one of the casings we frequently use for bombs to bury along the roads. Okay, this all sounds real good, right? Americans are sitting down talking. They're beginning to understand the place better. So why did the surge fail? It failed because the president said the purpose of the surge was to create a breathing space in which a political breakthrough could occur. That has not happened. In fact, General Odierno says in the book that the breathing space was created, but that some Iraqi leaders used it to move backwards, to become harder in sectarian differences. The most important reason that it failed is that none of the basic questions facing Iraq before the surge have been solved during that period. The surge is over, and all of these questions remain, most notably the disposition of oil revenue. How do you split it up among Iraqis? Second, what is the fundamental relationship between Kurds, Shiites, and Sunnis? Third, what will be the shape of Iraqi government? Will it be a strong central government in Baghdad that controls the country, or will it be a loose confederation of three or more entities? Fourth, what's the role of Iran? Iran is very influential in Iraq right now. Iran, I would say, is the big winner in this war so far. It's almost certainly going to be the case that eventually whatever government emerges 10 or 15 years down the road in Iraq is going to be more of an ally of Iran than it is of the United States. So what is the role of Iran? For that matter, what's the role of other foreign countries? Syria, Turkey, Saudi Arabia. All of them have said they have stakes in how this thing comes out. The Turks have made it clear that if they think Kurds are threatened to become an independent country, they will intervene. The Saudi Arabians have made it clear that if a Shiite-dominated government starts wailing on the Sunnis, that they will intervene. So you have in readiness a regional war if this is not handled right. So where are we now? What we have seen in the last month is the beginning of Obama's war. I think he has inherited the worst foreign policy situation that any new president ever has taken on. The worst foreign policy situation of any new president. And what's scary about that is it isn't even his number one problem. That, of course, is the economy. This first year for Obama promises to be harder than the last year of Bush's war. There are three reasons for this. First, Iraq is going to have three rounds of elections this year. Americans like elections, partly because we see them as the end of contention, the beginning of some form of political cooperation. In Iraq, they tended to have been the beginning of contention. Remember that purple finger election a couple of years ago, everybody so happy? 6 months later, a small civil war is breaking out, partly because that election intensified sectarian differences in identification. Second reason is this year you're going to have withdrawals of American troops. American troops at this point have become the glue in Iraq. They are the only thing keeping the lid on in a lot of places. Nobody wants us there, but nobody wants us to leave immediately. I think of one soldier I know up in Bakuba who had a conversation one day with one of these Sunni insurgents who had come on the American payroll. He hadn't become pro-American, but he was willing to take the money and not to kill Americans. And so this American soldier said, "Do you still want to kill me?" And the former insurgent said, "Yes, but not today." Well, that's progress. That's also kind of the general attitude toward the Americans. They want to kill us, not today. They want you to leave, but not today. They want you to stick around for a while. We will have some withdrawals, and as they go on, the more difficult they will become. The first troop withdrawals that have occurred, they took one brigade out, came from the easier areas, the areas that are considered more secure or where Iraqi forces are deemed more trustworthy or reliable. As the troop numbers come down, you're going to start taking troops out of areas that you find riskier, where you're not really certain of the Iraqi forces or where strong tensions are still present. And those troop withdrawals will come as the elections intensify with a round of general elections nationally scheduled for December of this year. Third, the fewer American troops you have in Iraq, the more likely Iraqi commanders will revert back to the old ways of the Saddam era. There are still a lot of little Saddams left in Iraq. Many of them were wearing the uniforms of the army and police. And when American troops are around, they tend to behave more. When they're not, they really feel they can do what they want. One thing that really struck me about this was a soldier who told me about a Turkmen police chief who was having a feud with a Kurdish village, wanted really to push the Kurds out of the village. So he used his pull, his wasta, with an Iraqi army general to get the Americans to come in and do an airstrike on the village. The Americans flew in, actually Apache attack helicopters came in, and they looked down and they talked to some American soldiers on the ground, and they declined to fire. They said, we don't see the threat that was described to us. We're not going to fire. And they pulled off and went away. A year or two from now, when there aren't as many American troops on the ground, you're not going to have that situational awareness, that knowledge of what's happening on the ground, and you might become more the pawn of Iraqi generals with their own agenda. So finally, and then I'll get to your questions, so you can start lining up here for questions if you like. The war is not over. It's a war that has changed constantly, as I said, but it is certainly not ended. I think Americans will still be fighting and dying in Iraq even when Obama leaves the White House. General Odierno told me that his ideal number for the year 2015 would be 30,000 to 35,000 troops, and that really is about the minimum you can get down to if you're going to have influence inside Iraq. If that proves accurate, 35,000 troops in the year 2015, well into what would be Obama's second term, then Obama's war in Iraq will be longer than Bush's war. At any rate, and whenever we get down to that number, it almost certainly is the case that the Iraq war is now going to be America's longest war. You can see why John Stewart calls me Mr. Sunshine. That takes care of my prepared remarks. Now I'd love to get into your questions, so please do line up at these two mics here. I just have one request. Don't be too polite. I'm a reporter, so you kind of need to ask pointed questions to penetrate the thick skin. So, thank you. Why don't we start with you?
Thanks.
Just out of curiosity, if you don't mind, what I'd like people to do is say your name and where you're from, just because I'm curious.
My name is Ken, and I'm a student here in the History Department. And I'm just curious, do you think that the wars that we're fighting right now will have the same effect or a similar effect on the American military and the American military establishment as the aftermath of the Vietnam conflict?
I don't think that the wars will have the same effect, but I think they will have a profound effect. Tom Friedman, who I see is speaking here in a few weeks, calls this the 1% war, which is that 1% of the nation's population has been fighting the nation's wars since 9/11, and doing it again and again and again. I know guys who have had 3 or 5 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan over the last 6 years. I run into privates in Iraq who have spent the majority of their time in the Army in Iraq, which is to say they came in and did a few months of basic training and then infantry training, got shipped out for a one-year tour that turned into a 15-month tour. So then they were about 15 and 15. Then they came home for 12 months, and then they went back for 15 months. It's a very difficult life we've put on these people, and it's even, I think, more difficult for their spouses. I was in a kindergarten near Fort Campbell, Kentucky, home of the 101st Airborne Division, a few years ago. And I was talking to the kindergarten teacher about how these kids of hers were reacting. The majority of the kids in the classroom, I think 18 out of 25 or something, had parents who were deployed to Iraq in the previous year. And she said, you know what really brought it home to me? November 2003, one of the kids came running in from the recess and yelled to the other students, kindergartners, yelled to the other students, two Black Hawks just collided over Mosul. These are 5-year-olds talking about Army helicopters colliding in this town in northern Iraq. These kids are carrying a huge burden. It is going to fray our military. It's going to have a long-term cost for a lot of people through PTSD. At the same time, the military we have now is probably the most highly trained, really agile, well-adapted military at least in ground forces, that we've ever had. It's a very well-educated military. It's a very cross-educated military. I remember I was hanging out with one infantry platoon in Baghdad once, and the platoon leader, 24-year-old, 2 years out of college, said to me, "We have two things we're doing here this year." He said, "First, we have a lot of downtime when you're cleaning your weapons and stuff. While the guys are cleaning their weapons, I have one guy who knows one subject particularly well, combat life saving, how to operate a 50 caliber machine gun, other stuff, or the signals guy who does the radio and so on. I have him lecture everybody else on his skills. So we're all cross-training." He said, "The second thing is I don't want them just sitting around watching DVDs on their downtime. And so I have a locker full of books, and everybody in this platoon is going to have read all those books by the end of this year. And if you can't read, I'll find somebody who can read it to you." And you see a lot of that. So I think it's a mixed bag, but yeah, it's a frayed military. It's a very strained military. It can handle about what it has now. It can't handle a lot more. And that's real worrisome if you have suddenly another large requirement placed on the military on the left field. Say, for example, Fidel Castro dies tomorrow and a civil war breaks out in Cuba. And the Organization of American States asked the U.S. military to provide humanitarian relief. Well, there's not a whole lot of troops available. I've interviewed guys, it was in the West Virginia National Guard, who had been back from Iraq 10 days when they got activated to deal with floods in West Virginia. That's a lot to ask of people. Yes, please.
Yes, I was wondering if you would mind answering a question about Fiasco, your previous book.
Sure.
On page 87...
Tell us who you are, where you're from.
Oh, Richard from Ventura. Okay. On page 87, you note that Anthony Zinni was talking about the neocons in the Bush administration and what they expected out of the Iraq war. And he said, quote, "Maybe there's some half-assed government in there. Maybe some strongman emerges. It fractures, and it's basically... And there's basically a loose federation, and there's really a Kurdish state." And then to go on, he says, "We're changing the dynamic. We're now," he's saying this is what the neocons are thinking, "we're now off the peace process as the centerpiece, and we're not putting any pressure on Israel." This suggests to me that Anthony Zinni, the head of CENTCOM back when, believes that the neocons in the Bush administration were out to destroy the nation of Iraq so that it would no longer present a threat to Israel, which in fact it did, and they, you know, sent missiles into Israel during the first Gulf War. What do you think of that conclusion, that that was the purpose that they had in mind, since they are such, have so many of them have such close ties to the Likud party in Israel?
Thank you. I have enormous respect for Anthony Zinni. He really is one of my favorite generals. I once referred to him in print because I was trying to describe the way he is both a really tough, smart, you know, gung-ho Marine, but also a genuine, thoughtful guy, reads a lot, tries to really understand cultural context and so on. And I described him in print as a knuckle-dragging intellectual. And he called me up and he said, "Ricks, what the hell, knuckle-dragging?" And I said, "General Zinni, it was a compliment." That said, I quoted Zinni. I mean, I don't agree with everybody I quote. I'd be a bad reporter if I did. You really try to bring in different points of view. I disagree with Zinni's conclusion that somehow the neoconservatives wanted to invade Iraq in order to ease Israel's security problems. First of all, that's a real three-cushion shot. It's hard to have any sense that this might work. The second thing is that Israel, by and large, opposed the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And I remember this at the time. When you talk to Israeli generals, they'd say, and they still say, "Iraq, what are you talking about? Saddam Hussein is an aging, toothless tiger." They always thought that Iran was the larger threat, both to them and to the West. Iran is a bigger country with a thriving economy, thriving oil exports, a live nuclear program, and both the motivation and the means to develop nuclear weaponry. And guess what? Invading Iraq did more to help Iran than it did for any other country. So I think actually the Israelis thought we were kind of nuts to invade Iraq. But also once it became clear to them that the Bush administration was determined to do it, they basically got out of the way and went and, you know, hid in the basement. until it's over. And you can see it has not helped Israel's security situation. It has made it more complicated. Iran has become more active in the politics of Lebanon. Hezbollah has become a model for how to take on the Israeli military, which they did in the summer of 2006 in Lebanon to great effect. And I think what you're seeing is other non-state forces and quasi-state forces like Hezbollah and al-Qaeda will increasingly imitate what Hezbollah did with the Israelis. You had Hezbollah light infantry with no aviation, no artillery, and no armored vehicles stop Israeli tank convoys using sophisticated rocket-propelled grenades, sophisticated tactics, and a lot of preparation. Even scarier, you had an Iranian-made rocket slam into an Israeli ship in the Mediterranean Sea. I worry that in Afghanistan, what we're going to see is a Taliban equipped more like that than the insurgents we've seen in Iraq, who basically had AK-47s, antique rocket-propelled grenades, and roadside bombs. That kind of force that can take out tanks, take out helicopters, and stop armored columns is a very scary force. So for a variety of reasons, I think Zinni was wrong. Thank you.
I'm Steve Humphreys. I teach Middle Eastern history here. I haven't been to Iraq. I haven't been closer than Jordan. So you're the person who would know. And I might just make one comment. Our younger son was a Marine infantry officer, and I can't wear his feathers, but he had deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan. So
is he home now?
What?
Is he home now?
Yes, he is. He became a graduate student. Imagine that.
good for him. And I should have said this. I think it's harder to be a member of a family with someone deployed in Iraq than it is actually to be in Iraq.
I don't know. I think you might. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. My question is a topic you didn't bring up, and I'd be curious what you have to say about it. And that is the effectiveness of the Baghdad government under Nouri al-Maliki. He appears from this distance, maybe it's just kind of a Potemkin show, but from this distance he appears to have developed as a more substantial politician than anybody thought, but I don't know what you think about the, just your comments on the effectiveness of the Baghdad government, if you could.
I'm of kind of two minds about it, partly because I think that Iraqi measures of effectiveness are not necessarily what we would look for. I was talking one day to David Kilcullen about this, and he said one of the big problems we have with the Iraqi politicians is they appoint corrupt people to be their generals. And he said that's because we want a general who's militarily effective, but Maliki wants a general who's politically reliable. He said we're not afraid of coup d'etats in our country. Maliki has to be profoundly afraid, especially as he has a venal political elite hiding inside the green zone, detached from the people, while the Iraqi army, under the auspices of the U.S. military, is out there meeting and talking to the people and becoming very familiar. So these are the classic conditions for a coup. So I think a lot of what Maliki does is trying to build up his own wasta, his own position and influence, not necessarily in the way we'd like it. So, you know, if you show yourself to be politically reliable, he'll deliver goods to you and services and electricity. If you're a Sunni, you're probably out of luck. Unless you really will come and somehow really promise that you will be part of his organization. Kilcullen pointed out to me that some of the most effective ethnic cleansing was nonviolent. It was the Ministry of Finance's refusal to issue permits to open banks in Sunni neighborhoods. If there's no banks in a Sunni neighborhood, the Sunnis have to drive into Shia neighborhoods with their piles of cash. And then they have to go through Shia checkpoints. And then they get robbed. The alternative is to leave. The Shiites are happy with either outcome. Another example, he said, was electricity. Sure, when you look at the overall statistics, you know, it's Baghdad has 76% of Baghdad has at least 18 hours of electricity a day or some number like that. But he said if you look at it, Shiite neighborhoods frequently will have 24 hours. Sunni neighborhoods sometimes will have 6 hours four times a week. So he said there's a variety of ways to implement this. So I think Maliki has exercised power on his own behalf, which I think is kind of semi-legitimate, It's yet to be seen whether he really will prove to be an Iraqi leader.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Bill Crawford. I live here in Santa Barbara. I'd like to hitchhike on one of your remarks at the very beginning, in which you ask for a show of hands of those who had been in Iraq or wherever. Obviously, I haven't. I'm a little slim on top and gray on the bottom. But I dare say there are at least 100 people who have been in our services, World War II, Korea, Vietnam. This has been and I have too, been a great concern to me. The idea that 2016, 2015, my God, I'll turn 100, you know, if the war is not over. But the whole idea, I have two grandsons, they're both draft age. When I think in terms of what's going on with our young men being all kind of worn out, making too many tours of duty, I begin to wonder what's going to happen if our war goes on. And so the bottom line for me is to ask you, why haven't we talked about the draft? Why haven't we talked about conscription? I thumbed through some papers today on Google, and I found that in the course of our history, there had been at least 12 drafts in the course of our history. It would seem to me that if we're going to be playing an important role in carrying this thing to some conclusion, that we're going to need more people, more boots on the ground than we now have. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a good question. This is always something that puzzled me about President Bush, the discrepancy or disparity between the intensity of his rhetoric, this is a war for survival, this is the biggest threat this country's ever faced, and the paucity of his request to the American people. You know, this is a war for our survival, go shopping. You know, to my knowledge, he never asked American kids to join the military, which you think he would have done. You know, maybe you want to think about it. There is a kind of draft right now, a backdoor draft. And unfortunately, it only applies to people who have already given. I just got a note a couple of days ago from a young former Army captain who had served in Iraq and had gotten out of the military and had gone to Columbia Journalism School, and I was trying to help him find a job in journalism. Good luck these days. And I got a note from him saying, you can put that request on pause. I've just gotten my recall notice. He's in the IRR, the Individual Ready Reserve, which is he doesn't drill anymore, but he is subject to recall for 6 years after getting out of uniform, or 4 years for him now. And he's being sent back to Afghanistan. And so this new career he is trying to start has to be put on pause. The other form of the backdoor draft is stop loss, when soldiers are told, your units, you thought you were getting out of the military in 6 months, but your unit's being shipped out in 2 months, so you're stuck for another 15 months. And you can get out at the end if you're still alive. The lack of American sacrifice, though, I think was a conscious political strategy that I think Karl Rove had thought about at the very beginning, which is get these things off the front page of the newspapers, out of the American consciousness as soon as possible. If you have a draft, you would really incite political opposition. I think the American people have been quite willing to tune out the Iraq war. We were talking to Ambassador Crocker about this one day, and he said, you know what I don't understand? He said, the American people think just because you walked out of the movie halfway through that it ended? Yeah, he said, we're still out here in the middle of this movie, but nobody seems to be paying attention to it back home. And I think that's kind of where we're at. A draft would really incite political attention, and also I think would engage people more and say, this is actually going to be part of your life. There's a real chance that you really need to think about this. I am profoundly ambivalent about Iraq. I would really love to get out of Iraq. I think it's going to be very hard to get out anytime soon. We are at the point where there are no good answers left. The question is, what's the least bad answer available? I remember I was being interviewed by KPFK, which I think is the Pacifica station in L.A., am I right? And the guy said to me, he's very strong, he said, Mr. Ricks, what do you say to all my listeners out there who say this war is immoral? And I said, well, shit, yeah. Come on, fella, of course it is. But that doesn't mean you can just turn it off like a tap. I mean, you're really stuck here. The question is if, I think both staying and going are immoral. There are no moral answers left. This is the fruit of the poison tree, the original sin of George Bush. He got us stuck there. And there are no good answers. And the question is, what are we as a people going to do about it? Where does moral responsibility lie? I think actually pulling out is in some ways the Jerry Rubin solution, because what we're going to be doing is grooving on the rubble. But I also think that President Obama's promise to get out in 16 months is not a departure from President Bush. I think it repeats his failure, which is persistent, unwarranted optimism about the situation. And I think for Obama, there's going to be a real growth period here in thinking about a deal with Iraq. My suspicion is that Iraq is going to change Obama a lot more than he changes it. Please.
Hi, I'm Jeanette Hagen, and I'm a PhD geology grad student here. But I'm also the daughter of a U.S. senator, Kay Hagen from North Carolina, who actually sits on the Armed Services Committee. So I have been taking notes and will be sure to pass them along to her.
Congratulations on your mother, by the way.
Thank you. I'm excited. I took a lot of time off to help her, and it was fun.
Is it a good geology major here, by the way? Or we have a daughter
who's... It's a great geology major, and I get to go hiking. So
well, good.
I enjoy it. My question is really, I saw a documentary just a couple of weeks ago that was talking about how there really wasn't that much sectarian violence or sectarian issues in Iraq. There was a man, he said, I'm a Sunni, my mom's a Shiite. And that really started happening more after we'd arrived. I was hoping you could comment on this and help us out, because people in the U.S. have trouble with this issue.
It's a good question. What the situation is, war tends to intensify sectarian identification. Yeah, before the war, people did get along. You'd see the same thing in the Balkans and Bosnia, you know, where people would say, you know, my best friend when I was a kid was a Serb, but it was never an issue. War tends to decivilize people, literally, to take away the aspects of civil society, to reduce people to the barest forms of identity. I noticed this as a kid. My family lived in Afghanistan for a couple of years, and when I went back to cover with some aspects of the war there, we're talking to a young Afghan when I was there, my age, and we're talking about the difference between the Kabul of the 1960s and the Kabul of today. And I said, you know, people seem just less polite. And he said, absolutely. He said, we have become a country of like really rude people. We've lost our sense of hospitality. Nobody trusts anybody anymore. I saw this also. I was once interviewing an Israeli psychologist who ran a program for Bosnian therapist, where they would fly Bosnian therapist to Israel for 2 weeks, 1 week rest and relaxation on the beach, and then the second week, a seminar where they talk to each other about what it was like to be a therapist in wartime. And one of the therapists said to him, Day, you don't understand my beginning point. He said, none of my patients are capable of trusting anybody of another class. He said, it's not just Bosnians don't trust Serbs. Women don't trust men anymore. Children don't trust adults anymore. And I think that's kind of where war has driven Iraq to. And it drives every country. If you, the Civil War, I'm sure you saw that sort of thing here as well.
Dale Noble, Santa Barbara. I had two bookend questions. You pretty much answered the second one. The first one is, why did Bush and company invade Iraq? And the second question, which you pretty much answered, is what if Obama goes ahead and keeps his campaign promise to pull out in 16 months? But if you'd address the first question.
Just quickly on the second one, Obama is not going to keep his campaign promise, partly because it's a nonsensical promise to have all combat troops out of Iraq. There are no non-combat troops. There is no pacifist wing of the U.S. Army. Now, there are frontline infantry troops, and there are support troops and mechanics. But frankly, I would much rather be with an infantry patrol on foot in Baghdad than in a truck convoy in Baghdad. Because of the truck convoy, they're going to get bombed. So will all American troops be out of Iraq in 16 months? Well, what I think when Americans heard that, what they thought was, oh, he'll have no more American dead in Iraq after 16 months. American troops will be in Iraq in many tens of thousands, for many years to come, and as long as we are there, unlike the occupations of Korea, Japan, and Germany. As long as we are there, American troops will be dying. So I think Obama's got another thing coming. Why did we invade Iraq in the first place? You know, as far as I can tell, reading the official record, there was never actually a Bush cabinet meeting to decide to invade Iraq. It just kind of happened, kind of like the whole Bush presidency. The real tragedy in this, as you look at it, is in 1954 with the Suez Crisis, America replaced Britain and France as the most influential Western country in the Middle East. For 50 years, we were able to have influence in that part of the world without having troops on the ground. In a retrospect, that wasn't a bad thing. Well, George Bush blew it. We have troops on the ground, and what we've learned is it's a lot easier to put troops into the Middle East than to get them out. And I wish we'd had a national conversation about that and about its meaning before we did it. To invade an Arab country with the explicit notion of altering its culture is not only probably the biggest, most ambitious mission this country has ever launched, it's probably the most foolish. Yet here we are in it, 6 years into it, with no sign of it ending. And no sign of any clear way to get out. This is one thing I think Americans need to realize. Sometimes you're in a situation where there are no good solutions. It's called a Greek tragedy, when you're facing only bad answers. And that's where we are. Last question.
My name's Jeff Shetler. I'm a teacher education student here, becoming a history teacher. Loved Fiasco, thought it was great. I haven't gotten to read your new book. In fact, I have a lot of friends who are Marines who get the first three or four pages through Fiasco and then have to throw it against a wall and can't read anymore because of the, the name of the book, the Fiasco.
This is actually, John McCain told me that with Fiasco, he actually got an enormous amount of exercise because he said he'd read it for 15 minutes, throw it down and say, son of a bitch. And then he'd go out and walk around the block. And then he said 15 minutes later, bam, and he'd walk around the block. But he finished the book.
Better than most of the Marine buddies I have, so they can't pick it up again just because of the mess that it was. But it seemed a big theme through that book was the politics aside was you had generals like General Petraeus and General Mattis who wanted to go out and be among the people and work the whole war that way as compared to, or I can never pronounce his name,
Odierno.
Odierno. Who really just went out and fought the traditional war that mm-hmm. he had been trained to fight. And my question is twofold. Having talked to all of these generals, and like you said, the economy has become much bigger than the war for Americans, and Obama had slipped in many troops into Afghanistan just a few weeks ago. Without much being said about it. And these people you are talking to, they're the people who are going to end up fighting that war also. Are we just transplanting bad tactics, do you think? Is that what is happening in Afghanistan? I heard an interview with the gentleman whose name I have forgotten who wrote Three Cups of Tea, mm-hmm. who was talking about we really need to build schools in Afghanistan. We need to sit down and listen to him, which seems to be more the Petraeus-Mattis approach, but it doesn't sound like that's where we're going in Afghanistan. So,
I think what you're going to see with Afghanistan is not the whole recipe book from Iraq transferred, but the attitude transferred. So, for example, everybody wants to build schools. The problem is when we've built schools and put in a school teacher, he's been executed by the Taliban. So you've got to not only got to put these things in there, you've got to protect them. And this is what Petraeus, the term they use is sustained presence. You can't show up and be what David Kilcullen calls a tourist, a war tourist. You've got to be there. We surfaced a generation of allies in Iraq and let them be slaughtered. Police chiefs, mayors, councilmen. You have 4 million people displaced from Iraq, 2 million internally, 2 million externally. The 2 million externally disproportionately are doctors, lawyers, journalists, professors, these are the secular middle class that was going to be the glue of the future of Iraq, the glue of democracy. What you got left is the hard men. in Afghanistan, it's a somewhat tougher situation because they didn't have even that essential middle class so much except in Kabul. I think you're going to see Petraeus try to disaggregate enemies to obey, and here I'll talk like an engineer, to obey the law of the conservation of enemies, which is don't make any more enemies than you need to have, which was not what our approach had been for several years. I think the other thing I'd like about what the Obama people have been doing with Afghanistan is talking about it as the Afghan-Pakistan war, which recognizes, first of all, it's a regional war. Second, you can't solve it just in Afghanistan. Not only is Afghanistan not the only part of the war, it's not the most important part of the war. And in fact, you could lose in Afghanistan, and you could survive it. America, you know, it would be bad, but not catastrophic. If Pakistan falls apart, you wind up with the prospect of Islamic extremists having nuclear weapons. Remember, that's one of the major goals of al-Qaeda and one of our nightmares. So I think there is much more focus on Pakistan, which is appropriate. As a friend of mine, Andrew Exum, says, it's hard to win a war in Afghanistan when the enemy decides to fight it in Pakistan. And that's kind of where we are now. We're recognizing that. The Taliban has been very effective lately in Pakistan. Al Jazeera showed some video recently of Pakistani tanks retreating from Taliban fighters. And you got to think, what do the Taliban fighters got that can make armored vehicles turn around like that? And this is what I mean by this sort of the Hezbollah-like presence. If the fighters in Afghanistan and Iraq start behaving more like Hezbollah and less like Iraqi insurgents, we have real trouble on our hands. And I think that's what the American military senses. Yeah, we're going to be there a long, long time. But we'll be out there trying to protect school teachers, trying to protect the people from the Taliban, but also from the Afghan police. You can't have a working economy if a truck driver gets shaken down five times by the police between the Pak border and Kandahar, which is what the situation is now. So I think they'll try to be minimally corrupt. We can live with that, but not so corrupt as to destroy the economy, to strangle the people, and to drive them into the arms of the Taliban, which is the situation now. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.